You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. This week on the pod, it's all about the filmmakers behind the film, Tatina. And today's guest is lead story artist Diveka Skuld. Let me share a little about the film before we begin. It's based on the thrilling story of polar explorer Roald Amundsen and Italian engineer Umberto Nobile. Tatina tells a truish story of glory and defeat, seen through the eyes of the street dog that became the world's first four-legged celebrity who traveled to the North Pole in a Zeppelin. Sounds fun, right? It is! I love this movie. The film is hand-drawn in 2D, interspersed with real-life footage, and it was produced in Norway and Belgium. So grab a beverage of your choice, sketch while you listen if you like, and enjoy.
Well, I'm a storyboard artist. I went to animation school. Like, I went to university for animation production in England, and that was not. I don't even think they had storyboarding actually in the, it wasn't in the curricular, like it wasn't a thing that we did ever. And I kind of, I know, because we made, you know, short films, like your bachelor movie, but you just never do storyboarding this. You just have to figure that part out yourself. But I remember when I finished afterwards, I was like, I wanted to do storyboarding. So I think I spent like 4 months maybe just making a portfolio just in storyboarding, just like being on YouTube and Googling everything that I could about what storyboarding is. It's not that much out there. At least it wasn't back then that much material out there. But then, yeah, I just decided that's what I wanted to do. And then I started working, and then I've been working, and I got a job and I started working as a storyboard artist, and I've been doing it since, I think that was like 2017. That was my first job.
And then, it's been over 5 years now, or about 5 years.
Yeah, it feels, when you say 5 years, that feels not that long. I feel older at heart. I feel like I should have been working for like 10 years, but five, that's not that bad actually. But yeah, I've done mostly storyboarding, but I've also worked, because when I'm in Oslo, there's a lot of smaller studios, and a lot of the time they want you to do, like, you have to be a potato. You have to be able to do a bunch of different stuff, basically. So I've done art direction on short films and commercials and stuff like that, and a lot of character design for that type of project. And then, storyboarding as well. But it's oftentimes like a package. You do the storyboard, and then you also do the character design, and maybe also the art direction if it's a short enough project.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm here in LA, and they always suggest focusing on a niche. And when you get outside of this bubble, yeah, it's like general, you want to be a generalist, so that Swiss Army knife, right? Did you like always know that it was animation you wanted to work in? Like, what started that bug?
That was super random, actually. I didn't think I was going to do anything art related at all when I went to college, I guess. Not college, what is it called in America? Like, between 16 and 19, basically.
High school.
High school, thank you. High school, that's the word. When I went to high school, I did only, I guess, science related courses like maths, and I guess I was supposed to do some kind of engineering or study physics or something science-y. And then when I finished high school, I applied for those universities and I got in, and I remember thinking like, I don't want to do this. Like, what this is what I thought I was supposed to do, and not necessarily what I want to do. You know, it was just like kind of expected that I took that route. And then I think I was just Googling like, what else can you do that's not becoming an engineer? And I found this animation course, and I realized, like, oh my gosh, because I'd always been really fond of drawing, but like just for myself, just in my spare time, doodling at the edges of my notebooks at school and stuff. And I think none of my parents or my family thought that was like an acceptable career path to take. I googled some stuff and I found animation, and I thought, this is genius. This is both movies that I love and drawing, and I can combine them. And I had that super stereotypical, like, oh, people make animation. Like, that was literally me being like, oh, wait a minute. Somebody actually drew this. And then I wanted to get into one specific school in the UK that I found. And I remember I had taken some time off, like I'd been working to travel with a friend of mine for the year after high school. And I was in some random apartment, like shared apartment with my friend in Buenos Aires. And I was just like drawing a bunch of stuff and making some really weird application for the school and thinking like, I'm not gonna get in, but whatever. And then I got in and I was super excited. And since then, I just immediately knew, like, yes, this is the right thing for me. I wasn't supposed to, whatever engineers actually do, I wasn't supposed to do that. I was supposed to work with something more creative. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that was just you following your gut instinct.
Basically, yeah.
Were you like nervous through that? Like, how did you know that it wasn't like just a whim and that it was like a full pivot moment?
I don't know. I think I've just always been I've been kind of spontaneous and like to follow my gut. And I think it was just as soon as I started and I realized I can do this, like I had this feeling like this is something that I could actually become good at. I thought, okay, this is what I want to do. And I've had many moments when I've been like, ah, okay, this is a lot harder than just getting a more stable job and being in an industry that's like, I don't know, there's just a lot of opportunity there. And especially in Norway, it's very niche to work in animation. And then of course my family were super supportive now, and they became supportive pretty quickly. But I remember when I told them, they were just like, what the heck? Like, what is this? And I think my grandpa still, like, he will still send me articles about, look how much this, engineer that went to the school that you got into earns in a year and blah, 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 stuff like that. And I'll be like, yeah, but I'm 30 now. I'm doing what I'm doing, like it's going okay. It's, yeah. So I don't know. I think I just liked it. And then I just decided to stick with it, basically.
Yeah,
Yeah.
kept leaning into what was feeling good. So, talking about the animation industry over there, like, is it a lot of like boutique studios that hire on people per project, or like, what's the landscape like?
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of really small studios. They have people who are there all the time. Like they have in-house people as well, but it's very usual that they will hire in people to work on like shorter projects and stuff like that. And because I've also worked on things that are not made in Norway, and I've lived abroad and worked abroad, I always wanted this. I didn't want to work in-house like full-time and do a lot of smaller projects. I wanted to be able to jump on this one little project that, seems to fit me. So that's why I've never been like what's the word, like hired long-term in any of the Oslo studios. I guess Totino was pretty long-term, but it was still just like it was project-based, and it was only for the period that Totino was in production. So, but that's the longest I've been on a project, or I was supervising a project last year that was also the same kind of time frame. But it's always like project to project, and then
Yeah.
yeah.
Because it's, project to project, do you find that you ever have to diversify the kind of work you do? Do you like go to craft fairs, sell prints, or anything like that, or like
What is
freelance and
that?
tech, et
That
cetera?
Fairs? What is craft fairs?
Craft
Sorry.
fairs or comic cons, you know, they have the artist
Oh, right.
alleys to sell stuff, just
Yeah.
like your own business. Because I found that some of us over here, or a lot of us actually, especially this year, it's been very dry for a lot of people. So we're like, what else can we do right now to pay bills?
Yeah. I know a lot of people did, but I've never done that actually. I mean, the like second income source I've had in times has been doing illustrations for commercial studios. Like they will, or maybe it's like I don't know how to say this properly in English, but basically it's like a company that makes articles about stuff. Like it could be for example, a telephone company. They want to make an article about how they will like they've started a program to prevent frauds happening to, you know, people or something, and then they need illustrations for that. So it's like, I guess, commission, like commercial illustrations for different
Yeah,
companies.
editorial illustration is
Thank
another
you.
way of saying it too. Both are
The
good.
good way, the right way, or you can spend like 5 minutes trying to describe the ad like I did. But yeah, okay, yes, that's I've been doing that, but I've never made illustrations and sold them or anything like that. But that's actually something I would really like to do. So I'm trying to like get into that, you know. I was talking to a friend about it yesterday that it would be cool to do more personal work and actually, you know, see will anyone buy this? Because I have friends who do that quite regularly. Like they go to fairs and markets and they sell their work. And yeah, it's also just a nice way to do stuff for yourself and also feel like it's going towards something, you know. So yeah, it would be nice, but I haven't done it so far.
Yeah, because like it is very satisfying to work on a lot of these projects, but at the end of the day, it's like it's not ours at the same time, you know? And especially when I don't know if you felt this, like you'll be on a project and like everyone feels like your extended family, and then like you roll off and like you're like, oh, like they're all just gone, you
Yeah,
know?
I had this. I
And yeah.
really was gonna say I really had this feeling like a couple of months ago. I was on this project in Paris, and it finished, and I think we were 15 people working in the storyboarding department, and we were all the same age, and it was this like really like loving friend group feeling, and the last week everyone was just super like depressed thinking that, oh, and for me as well, because I'm moving, like everyone else lives in Paris, you know, we can still kind of hang out and see each other, but I was leaving the country and I had this really like, okay, now it's over and you're by yourself. And yeah, so I understand what you mean with that.
Gosh, do you have to travel a lot per project like that?
No, I mean, when I've worked in France and in China actually, despite
Oh.
it was my first job after university. So that was in Nanjing in China. I was there for I think only 6 months, but it was we went back and forth to China like four times. So I've been on a lot of long flights to Nanjing. Yeah, it was that project. And then after that, I went straight to work on a series in Paris. And I was there also for 8, 9, no, maybe more. Like, yeah, no, maybe 8 months. Because of projects, they had to rewrite the script. And then I think that's kind of a thing that's happened sometimes that, you know, you start on something and then, I mean, it's very normal, I guess, but
Yeah, it is.
start working on something and then it's like, oh no, sorry. You have to rewrite everything. You have to take a 4 month pause and you're like, what am I supposed to do for 4 months? So actually, that's how I ended up back in Oslo. I didn't really think I was going to go to Oslo that soon after university because I'd already been living in England, and I did an exchange year in Japan, and I was really like hooked on traveling, and I just wanted to move around with each project that I was working on. So then the project that I was working on that was really lovely, it's called Arcane. It's like a Netflix series, and it got like put on pause, and I decided to go back to Oslo then, and then I stayed, and then COVID happened, so I kind of also stayed in Oslo, I guess because of that.
Did you
Yeah,
end up
but
going back to Arcane?
yeah, it was that's where I just was in Paris on season two, which is also a very nice and interesting project to them as a storyboard artist because it's so it's for adults, it's full of action, it's very action-packed, and yeah, I don't know, I love that project. That's like one of my favorite things that I work on, I think. And it's also so many talented people, and so many people. It's rare in Europe that you have a production that size, I think. It's really massive, and they're doing everything in-house, which is also I know we talked about this on the like the other day, Tony was saying that in Europe you usually have to find like co-productions, a lot of different co-productions to get funding, and this is just, I mean, it's an American company and a French company obviously doing it together, but it's cool that everything is just done there, and if you need something from the art department you can just walk over, or you don't need to email anyone. It's like it's cool, it's very
Yeah,
cool.
that is very nice. And Arcane Season 1, because that's what's out at this moment, like, so good. So that's so cool that you work on it. I think there was a moment. I mean, the animation is just so gorgeous, but like literally like I had to rewind the show to watch like this one shot where the character had like this long booger out of his nose, and it was just like so detailed. Obsessed with it.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah. So what is your setup like at home? Like, do you have like a Cintiq or how, like, what do you work
Yeah.
on?
Yeah, I work on a Cintiq. I have three different sizes, I think, depending on like if I need to travel or come here or yeah. But yeah, we have the most weird setup ever in my apartment where I work when I work from home, because we have such a small place that we've made this like super MacGyvery solution thing happening, because I need to be able to have my space and have a room that I can close, where I can close the door and work to just be alone and not have any distractions. Yeah, we've made this like really weird thing with the desk is like coming down from the wall, and it's a lot of stuff happening, but it gives me a room to work from, which I need. Yeah, but then I have like a normal setup with the Cintiq and a computer. And yeah,
That's cool.
it's very basic animation setup, I feel like.
I love that, like, problem solving is something that a storyboard artist has to do, like, every shot, right? It you did that with your space. I think that's fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about craft. Like, when you're given a script, like, can you talk about the process, like when like you're launched on a sequence or given a script for the first time? What are the conversations with your director like, and how do you break down the work?
That's interesting. I feel like I work very differently depending on the projects. Because if it's I mean, and I also get inspired by the people that I work with. For example, on Arcane, they're very like some of the guys that I work with, they're so good at thumbnailing that it's basically like a finished. Like you could just put post-it notes on top of each other and it would be the most like perfect animated, like
Whoa.
with colors and shadow and like everything would just be there and it all matches and it's great. And I'm like, you know, I'm much rougher. When you look at my thumbnails, it's I have to be there to describe, you know, what's in front of you most of the time. But then I get inspired by how they work, and I'm like, okay, I want to try to be more detailed with my thumbnails and to try to see more like the whole vision. But a lot of the time I start that way, and then I kind of float into this more like I'm just testing out a bunch of different stuff in the program I'm working in. And I think I just need to see things move to feel the direction that I'm going in with the board. But yeah, I usually have something really rough that I want to show the director quite quickly to see that we're on the same page. And then we meet again and again and again. No, but it depends. It also depends on the director. Some directors have really clear guidelines for exactly what they want. They've almost thumbnailed it before you start. When you're launched, it's like, here's the thumbnails, almost. And you're like, okay, I'm just gonna do this, is great. And other times it's like, I want something, I don't know, like romantic, but also sad, but also, and then they give you like one line of a script, and you're like, okay, I'm just gonna try to figure something out. But that's fun. It's fun that it's different, and yeah, at least show really rough stuff very quickly to feel like I'm doing what the director wants, because that's what you're doing. Like you're saying, it's not my baby, it's the director's baby, and I have to try to figure out their vision, I guess. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know as someone who sketches rough, it's embarrassing to let someone see such rough sketches, but you're totally right that, get it down on paper, to get what they're seeing faster. And I feel like, directors at the point that they're directing, they've been around and seen a lot of different like rough work. Like there's no
Yeah.
reason to be embarrassed over the rough sketches.
But that's true, but it's also when I work on Arcane, that's absolutely true. Like you can show anything and the director, he's great, and he will just understand, like I know, and like he knows animation, like he knows the process, and he can see something and kind of read it immediately, or at least he trusts you to make something out of it. And then I've worked with directors who come from live action who's never done animation before. And then you're in the mindset that, yeah, this is a director, he's gonna understand. I'm gonna show him this rough thumbnails, and suddenly someone's asking you, like, why are they standing on a disco floor? And you're like, oh, that's like the perspective grid. And it's like, no, they can't be standing on a disco floor. Like that shouldn't be in the movie. And you're like, okay, we're really on different levels in terms of understanding how animation and storyboarding works within like the animation frame. So yeah, I've definitely had both. And the first one is easier, obviously, but it can be fun to work with. Is working with a live action director is also it's different, and it's interesting in its own way, because they have their own way of thinking film, I think, a lot of the time. So
Talking about Arcane and Tatina, they're very different projects. How does your process change depending on the style of storytelling of the movie or TV show?
I think it's a qu quite an organic process. It just happens naturally, I think, when you're working on something so different, how you approach it. And with Arcane, I think we had I when I started, there was already people who had been working on it for like at least a while. They had done the pilot when I started, so I had a lot of reference in terms of what they expected from me and what they wanted to see. And so it was pretty clear, and you had a lot of inspiration. So kind of attacking that was very different from Titina, where it was, I also started when there'd already been done some storyboarding, but they hadn't decided on any specific style at all. So everything looked very different. And I think that's what initially happened, because with Titina, I started just doing some storyboarding. I just started it, like I didn't start as lead, I wasn't hired on as lead. It kind of just happened, because the role kind of just fell upon me throughout the production, and I realized, like, okay, I'm kind of falling into the role of lead here. And then I think it also happened because me and Kaisa started talking a lot about, actually, we need to make ev all the storyboard artists need to make the same movie, and we need to set a style in it. And Kaisa had such a, like, she had this huge block of inspiration, and she really knew what kind of movie she wanted to make. And it was just about trying to kind of push the vision that she had in one direction, you know, like because I think one of the struggles, for example, with Zatina in the beginning was that it was, I'm starting to ramble about Zatina now, but one of the struggles that we had was that it was she wanted this kind of Wes Anderson-y aesthetic to it, but it was also almost a silent film when I started working on it. And that combination of like very still pictures that weren't very dynamic and also no dialogue was kind of, that's the thing, that's one of the reasons why Wes Anderson's work is because of the dialogue on top of the image. Like it's a combination of the two. So we decided like, okay, we need to try to make it a lot more dynamic than it was. And we need to try to find some kind of mid ground between Wes Anderson and like something more I don't know, Miyazaki-ish, which is also, you know, a director that everybody loves and also Kaisa loves. So something that was a bit magical and a bit more, had more depth to it than Wes Anderson, I think. So that was really like a journey of trying to find the aesthetic and the style. And then with Arcane, it was for me to try to do the same stuff as the really talented artists who were already there and had set this very clear. I mean, I was the supervisor on Arcane season one, who was Simon Andrevaux. He was I think he just set the style because he was so good that I feel like just everything that he did was like that's what everybody else was trying to do, you know, like it was just very clear, and he would also guide you. I mean, I that was my first job was in Nanjing in China. It was a very, I did a bit of everything. I did storyboarding, but it was like it was so in the beginning stages of the film production that I ended up doing like everything from script writing to like revisions to concept art to everything. So Arcane was kind of my first proper actual storyboarding job. And I remember coming there and being like, why am I here? Like everybody's so talented. What am I doing here? And I had to really just try to really quickly learn how to do it. And I remember Simon was super helpful and kind of taking me under his wings and being like, I'm gonna help you and I'm gonna kind of show you how you do it. So, and then he would sit down with you and draw over what you did and really, yeah, it was kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Like he was good at keeping everyone within the style of the show, I guess. So it was never kind of going in the wrong direction.
Yeah,
If
that was
that makes
probably
sense.
totally. That was probably super helpful for when you became a lead too, having seen what good leadership looks like, you know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, on Tatina, I wasn't, I think I wasn't giving feedback to any of the other artists. It was more about developing the style and talking with Kaisa about more what she, I never directly talked to any of the storyboard artists because Kaisa was so, she was always there, like right next to me in the studio, and she would do the reviews. And then it was more of trying to kind of get it in. I would do a lot of rough thumbnails and sketches for the other artists, and then they would kind of base what they did on the really, really, really ugly rough stuff that I did, trying to guide people in that way. But it was different when I supervised the last time. It was more like, okay, I have a team, and the director is talking to me, and I am talking to my team, and it was more like that. But Tatina felt really small and like this very cozy little group of people who were just, everybody were just talking. And I don't know, it wasn't any, I'm not gonna be able to say this word, hierarchy. I feel like my
You
brain
got
is
it.
just great. At Zatina, I think it was a very flat structure and that was really lovely. And yeah, a bit
That's really
different.
cool. Yeah, and the movie, like you said, is, you know, super cozy and just, you know, it feels like a lot of love went into it. You had mentioned, because a few days ago we had done this live talk for Women in Animation,
And you had mentioned then in that webinar that after boards wrapped, you were off the production and, onwards to the next thing. And so they were still working on it for a while. And the first time you saw the movie was actually in the theater.
Yeah, that was was very interesting because I had seen like a couple of clips. It was a long time before the movie was like I saw the actual movie for the first time, but I'd seen some clips where they had some animation and it was like some backgrounds, but it wasn't really comps. It was kind of a really rough version of it with the music, and they just wanted people to see it. And I think it was because they had some problems like with strobing or something, and they wanted to see if does anybody else notice this, you know? So I'd seen some clips from it before, but I had no idea that how close it would be to the storyboards that we delivered, for example. And that was really fun. I remember watching it and thinking like, oh, okay, it's the boards. It's really like it's the boards that's come to life. And that was really fun to see because I was afraid that I remember the end of the team. I worked a lot. We had been this amazing team before, and then we were supposed to be finished, and it was the deadline, and the only one who was on it in the end were me was me, and I was just doing a bunch of like really really rough stuff to try to give them. You know, they needed this one scene, or instead of Amundsen doing this, we need him to do this, and it was a lot of tweaks. And for the last for 2020, I remember. I was sitting, you know, alone and doing a bunch of stuff and sending it in. And I was like, what? I don't know what's gonna end up in the final film or what it's gonna look like. And I was afraid that it was too rough because we it was a, you know, it's very typical for low budget. I mean, Titina wasn't that low budget, but you know, it's not a Pixar movie. But you have to do kind of rough storyboards. Like you have to do a lot in a short time. So it's like, okay, are they going to be able to read this? They're in Brussels, they're in a different country. Like, are they just gonna decide to go in a different direction, or do they have to do it differently? Like, I don't know, is it readable? You know, I was thinking about all these things, like, and I remember watching it and thinking like, okay, yes, it was readable. Like, the movie is still like, if you put the movie and the storyboard side by side, it would be pretty similar. And that was really fun to see.
Yeah. And talking more about Zatina, there's this well, I wanted to tell you my favorite scene. It's a telephone scene, but I also want to know what your favorite scene to board was.
Maybe the telephone scene. I really
Yeah.
love the telephone scene.
It's so
And I
good.
really love that they kept the woman with the big breasts that's lying on the table, and like one of them is falling down. And I remember everyone were like, haha, like that's so like silly that her boobs are on the table. And I was like, maybe they're not gonna keep that part. And then they pushed it because I hadn't drawn it, you know, so detailed that actually like they kind of fall down and follow her, and I remember like, yes, they took the gag and just ran with it, you know. But that was really fun, and it was a challenging shot to do because it's so much stuff happening at the same time, and you need to be able to read, you know, both conversations happening, and because it's a split screen, you have to approach it a bit differently. But it was just really fun. The characters are so fun. And that was great about Titina was that we had all these really funny, great characters already designed. So when it came to drawing expressions and like being inspired by what the characters might do, you had a lot already just by the visuals. In the character design, they were super inspiring. So. But I don't think I had the character designs for the women actually when I did it the first time. The two ladies talking, like putting him over from Norway to Rome, I think, or Norway to Italy. So I think they kind of happened simultaneously with I don't know who inspired who, but yeah.
To give the audience just a little bit of context for the telephone scene in particular, So like the whole movie, and I hope everyone will go give it a watch. I teared up as much as I gasped and laughed like throughout the whole movie. Like it was very sweet and just really entertaining. But there, this telephone scene like has, I don't want to say the most acting, but it, like up until that point, it's been very like minimal, like movement, very subtle acting and stuff like that. But then you get to this telephone scene where this, you know, Amundsen is asking Nobile to build an airship to go to the Arctic because he's an explorer. They're like twiddling with the rotary phone cord and doing all the secondary action while having this conversation. And it's the most like physical movement that has happened on screen up until that point, really, at least for the main character. There's obviously a lot happening in the Mussolini scene as well, which was really hilarious, by the way. I thought the gags in that scene were great. But yeah, it's so good.
It was really fun drawing Mussolini as this tiny, angry man.
Yeah, I did not expect him to be in the movie. And like, I didn't know what to expect, honestly, watching it. And then it was just a delight all the way through. I'm like, what is this? It's so sweet. Like, nothing like it, I feel like, would ever be made in the mainstream market, at least over here.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, number one, it's, well, this isn't fair to say. I was going to say there's a lot of older characters, and usually, like, we have like like young kids as the lead characters for kid movies, because usually the main character is the same age as our target audience. But, you know, with Up, we did have Carl, so that's we're getting better, obviously. But it was really great to see so many heartfelt designs of older characters, you know, like all of the caricatures, like they were just so good. Like I felt like I've known people that look like this, you know. It was great. And yeah, I know you did do the character designs, but I just love it.
Yeah, I mean, Siri Duckin, who did who was like the lead character designer and who did all the I mean, she basically set the style for all the character designs, and of course other people came on and helped develop them into something that was maybe more animatable, I guess. Because Sita is what's the word I'm looking for, like when you draw for newspapers, and she has this very caricature-y look to what she usually does. Like that's her speciality, basically, is like she will draw these amazing political critique drawings, you know, for newspapers, and she's amazing, and she's very good at capturing the essence of a person and putting it into a design. So I think that's really special for Titina, is that there are so many really unique characters. Even the background characters are really unique, and they have their own personality, and yeah, that was definitely very fun in storyboarding, just having all these background characters that are just not, you know, a neutral character that you're just going to see for 2 seconds, so it doesn't matter that much what they look like. They're like really thought through, and yeah, like you said, she, and I think for her as well, it was very important to make people like normal people. Like she wanted to draw people that you see on the streets, and she wanted to draw people that you know, and she wanted to have different shapes and sizes and faces and ages. And yeah, it's very, it's really fun, and it's I think it makes the movie a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
definitely. Where do you get your inspiration from, or how do you stay motivated?
Oh, by a lot of stuff, by a lot of I mean, by people I work with a lot of the time. It's very inspirational, and I guess just being like a movie nerd and loving movies and loving cinema, and yeah, just watching a bunch of films and getting inspired by that. I love doing research for scenes and like really digging into, you know, cinematography and trying to find something cool. So a lot of the time, that's, yeah, That's what keeps me motivated. I mean, now it's inspirational to be able to work on also very different projects and not just stay within one lane. And I've been lucky to be able to work on projects that, like you said, Tatina and Arcane, they're very different. And yeah, whenever I feel like I've been on something for a long time and it finishes and I need a break or just to like refresh my head and try to you know, I don't know, get energy back and become excited again. I like to do shorter projects for a time, and I love, that's one of the good things about working with not necessarily commercials, but like informational movies and stuff like that, where you will have you will work on something for 2 months and then it's out and then you can see it. And because, like you mentioned before, obviously with storyboarding, you work on something and then it has to go into production afterwards, after pre-production is over, and then it will take a while until you can actually see what you did on screen. And it's very cool to work on stuff where it's just like, I remember the first time I started working in a small studio, and it was just, I just we just had finished short films like popping out like every 2 months, and I was like, oh, it's so cool to see what you designed and worked on. It's like a finished product after such a short amount of time. So that's usually also inspirational. Just feel like just making a bunch of stuff, a bunch of different looking stuff, because clients want different stuff, you know, like the different aesthetics. And yeah.
What are some of your favorite movies that you consistently go back to?
Ooh, that's hard. There's a lot of movies. When you ask me that question, like right now, I've just been watching really like trashy TV, and I'm like, oh my God.
It's a good palate cleanser, to be honest. I've done my own fair share of trash TV.
Yeah, yeah.
This past week, even.
Yeah, but I mean, I love movie. I really like science fiction movies. I love fantasy, like stuff that's kind of out of this world. And I love movies that are really lush, if that makes sense. Like, there's a lot of visuals happening, a lot of stuff happening. Like with Miyazaki's movies, like that's movies that I can just put on any day when I'm just like, I just need to look at something pretty. And I really, really like to watch movies where there's just like fun, where it's very character focused more than plot focused. Like, I really love, I think for me, that's also always inspirational to watch series and movies that's like has a lot of character and weird characters and weird, you know, dysfunctional families or people who, I don't know, who are just really, fun and interesting to watch. I'm into that more than, you know, action movies or stuff that's more plot, has more focus on a strong plot, I think.
Yeah.
Makes sense. It's a very vague answer.
No, I think that's great. I love that you know the type of stories that you're drawn to, you know, because in the way that's a niche, a good niche to know where. Like, if a dysfunctional family script comes your way, you're like, I'm on it.
Just specifically dysfunctional family. So it's like, like, I think that's the last movie I watched was like, again, was like Little Miss Sunshine. I think that's why it popped into my
I love
head.
That
like,
movie.
I love that kind of, I don't know, just, you know, weird people stuck together in a situation and then life just happens. It's, yeah, it's good. And I just watched, or I didn't just watch, but I was just talking to my sister about, because she saw this Amazon Prime series called The Favourite, which I absolutely loved. That was one of the best things I've seen in such a long time. And she apparently loved it too. And we were just like nerding about like all the great aspects of this series and why it's so good. And I don't know, I just really love discovering good series and good movies. It's the best feeling when you find something and it's actually like really well written, and yeah, and it looks beautiful, and you're just like, oh, I found this treasure now and it's mine forever. Yay.
I'll have to look that up. I haven't heard of that one.
It's really good. You should watch it. I'm trying to get people to watch it. So far, my sister.
So with like different, you know, there's action or there's like romance, they're like different genres of the type of scenes that you could get in a storyboarding job, and probably multiple, right? But how do you practice those things like on your own? Like if, you know, someone's listening who is still getting their skills, you know, up to snuff, like what's a tangible practice that they can do to get better at like action or suspense, et cetera?
It's really just like copying other people a lot. I think if you're starting out and you want to learn to get better at, say, drawing action, really look at action movies and look at other storyboard artists that you like that do action, and just like walk through it scene by scene, see how they edit, look at the timing, just really geek out and try to to see like exactly how exactly does this artist work and compare artists. But I think it's about just doing it a lot of times and really learning the language of an action scene, and then yeah, whenever you're asked to do it, it comes naturally, you know what to do. But I think you need to do it a lot of times and to look at a lot of references. And I mean, like I said, I love when I get a scene to just really go online and try to find a bunch of movie references. And yeah, just like if it's something that I'm not so comfortable with, or if I feel like, okay, I know this, like I know how to do this, but I want to see how other people do it. I want to see like maybe there's something I haven't thought about, or maybe there's like a different direction that I could go that's not just my initial thoughts. I think one of the sequences I did now on Arcane was supposed to be a jump scare, and I was like, yeah, I know how to do a jump scare, you know, but then I was like, do I? Maybe do I need to actually do some research on this? And I just went online and I looked at like all the jump scares in every horror movie ever made, and yeah, just really looked at it and looked at, you know, the timing and the build-up and the suspense and which ones I liked and which ones I didn't like and why I liked them and all of that stuff. And then, but that's because I that was a thing that I had never done a jump, like I had never drawn an actual jump scare before. You've just seen a million of them, so you feel like, yeah, I know everybody can do a jump scare. And then when you dig in a bit deeper, you realize like, oh, there's so much, you know, there's so much to this that I haven't actually thought about. So, and now I know, it was also kind of just for me because I don't really like horror movies. And now I know all the jump scares in every horror movie, so I'm prepared. I can watch anything now.
Yeah, that's so intriguing. Because, yeah, I would think having seen a bunch of jump scares, like, I know what that's like. But no, it's, you know how to react to it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's so smart that you'd go and, like, you know, intake and kind of marinate in those that have come before, you know, that makes so much sense. And like, you know, with things like that, as well as like working in genre, there are like kind of promises that you make, like being in that, like this is a sci-fi, there are some tropes that you could play with, you know, find fresh takes. And I just like listened to a talk yesterday about like making promises and meeting expectations. So okay. It's so cool to hear you say that.
Yeah, cool.
So we'll wrap up. Thank you so much for hanging in here with me. What is something you know now that you wish you knew sooner?
That was such a simple question. And I was like, what did I wish? There's so many things I wish I knew sooner. But I think that it's, I think just, I wish I knew sooner that it's okay to try and to fail at stuff, like even in a professional setting. And it's okay to come up with, how do I say this? Like, it's okay to be outspoken about stuff and ideas, and to, I don't know, just have a bit more guts, you know, like know what you want. And if you know what you want, go for it. That's basically it. I think that's super stereotypical.
Oh, but I love it though.
But be able to just take up space if you feel like you deserve it. When I was younger, I was really afraid of, you know, not delivering something perfect straight away when I started working in a, on a project, or and just being able to understand that it takes a bit of time to get into a new project, to learn it, and to be able to go to your director and not have something perfect all the time. I think just like, it's your everyday, it's your life, you're gonna go to work every day, you can't feel like stressed that you're not gonna deliver something perfect all the time. So yeah, cutting yourself some slack and yeah, taking up some more space is also fine. That yeah. makes
That's wonderful advice. And yeah, something I've been thinking about a lot. I feel like I keep coming across this epiphany though, where it's like, you know, get out of your own way. Like, yeah. you don't have time for that. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just like, it's fine, you know, like, just don't be so hard on yourself. It's okay. People make mistakes. And it's the same like when you're working with other people, I try to think, you know, because you do something, I don't know, like you're not good enough, you feel like you're not good enough at what you do, and then you realize after working with some, like with people for a while, you realize everyone is feeling this, and you're like, oh, we're all feeling this, like why are we all just going around being stressed that we're not doing, you know, a great job, and then everybody thinks everybody else is doing, you know, amazing work, but they're not living up to the expectations, and it's just like, you know, it's not leading anyone anywhere. We're just getting tired and yeah, so I don't
yeah.
know where I was going with that, but I think just, yeah, you need to not be so hard on yourself, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably a good chunk of our burnout and stress and everything does come from ourselves having too much expectation on our own
yeah.
self. You know, just because you brought it up, like, how do you deal with imposter syndrome?
Oh, that's, I have this thing where I feel like I can be overly confident when I like apply to something, or I'm like, yeah, I got this job, I can do it, it's gonna be cool. And then when I start, I get massive imposter syndrome and I'm like, oh my God, you know, they're all gonna figure me out, I'm a fraud, like super stressed. And then usually, you know, you realize quite quickly that that's just, you just get tired of having that feeling. Like I said, like most people have imposter syndrome at one point. Even the people that you look up to that you think are, you know, perfect at what they do, and your whole wish is just, or all your wishes is just like become as good as that person, and you realize, oh, they also have imposter syndrome. So yeah, I don't know. I think just really trying to remind yourself that it usually works out okay. If you try, if you put in the work and you are nice to people and you show up on time and you're, you know, trying to be inspired and just trying to have fun at what you do. Like, I think that's really important to remember, especially when you get imposter syndrome and you're just stressing out like about work, that, you know, you actually like this job and it's actually fun, and you should try to just be there and just learn. If you get the feeling of imposter syndrome, be like, okay, I'm just gonna learn how to do it then, and then eventually you're gonna realize that you already know how to do it and it's all fine.
Nice.
Ah. that's a weird answer.
No, maybe. It's not.
Yeah,
it's good. And you know, a good thing to remember as well for everyone is like, you know, the whole process is iterative, you know, we're there to make it better, you know,
yeah.
Like you need a starting point. So
yeah.
Each pass is going to get better and better. So hopefully that cushions a little bit of that anxiety.
Yeah, that's true. It's really, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I don't have any healthy habits of what I do. You're like, so what do you do with that? You're like, what's your healthy, like, what's your good habits, like dealing with? And I'm like, I don't know. I usually just go home and I'm like, ah. But then you have to go to work the next day and then it just fades out. But yeah, I think the older I get, the nicer I get to myself about being like, it's work, you're here to do this thing. But yeah, I think just getting like, just really realizing that it's every day and you're going to work for many years, and And you have to be nice to yourself, and you can't kill yourself for every project. You just have to do the best you can and then go home, make dinner, and live your life. Like, I don't want to get burned out on a project. Like, if it's that chaotic, or if someone's expecting you to, you know, do a bunch of overtime or work more than what's possible to do, then that's just not a nice place to work. And I think that's also all right to acknowledge that, like, yeah, you're just a human. You need some basic things, and I don't know, you just need to take care of yourself, I think, and realize that it's a job after all. Even though there's, I think it's difficult in our field, because it's so much about, like, you have to have a lot of pride in your work, and it's this kind of feeling like we're doing this because we're passionate about it, and, you know, like, this is what we love to do, and everybody else has a 9 to 5, and they're just like, I hate my job, I'm just gonna go home at 5, and then I kind of work for the weekend. Or, and within arts, it's just like, no, I don't do that because I love what I do, and that's why I do it. And so you have to put so much, like, into work all the time, and I think it's okay to sometimes be, tell yourself that it is just a job. Not every job has to take everything out of you. Like, if there is something you're super passionate about, put your energy there, but not all the time. It is a job after all.
Yeah. And that kind of level of, it's unsustainable long term, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a delightful conversation. Do you want to, you know, share your social media or website for people to check out your work and follow your escapades in animation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Instagram, so, and it's at DevaKidDrawStuff, which I guess people aren't gonna find because my name is hard to, like, understand. But yeah, it's DevaKe DrawStuff.
Nice. And I'll put it in the show notes as well for easy click.
Yeah, I mean, you can, it's there, I think there's a link to my website and stuff as well, but it's unfortunately not much storyboarding at all, and it's very rarely updated, and it's mostly just, you know, lunch break doodles that I'm like, I doodled this while I ate a bagel, and now I'm gonna post it on social media. So that's, you're in for a treat if you go on Instagram.
I love that. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you, Cassie. Yeah.
Paint Folk is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women and non-binary folk in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by the year 2025. Learn more at womeninanimation.org. This episode was produced by me, Cassie Soliday, music by Dominique Parker. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk podcast. Stay colorful.